This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's also you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Hey, everyone. It's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for up to half the cost. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Savings based on cost of Consumer Cellular single line 1, 5, and 10 gig data plans with unlimited talk and text compared to lowest cost single line postpaid unlimited talk, text, and data plans offered by T-Mobile and Verizon January 2024.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
Hello, this is Let's Talk About Myths, baby, and I am your host, Liv, back with another conversation episode. Today I had on returning guest, Megan Cleveland, who is just so flippin' lovely and loves Thebes as much as I do. And I mean, what more could I ask for? Megan came on to talk about not only Thebes, but also that cursed family of Oedipus and his, you know, sibling children. Megan has written a YA retelling about Ismene, the daughter of Oedipus, and so I was thrilled to have her back on the show to talk all about that, because I love Thebes. But I also love the idea of YA Greek myth retellings, because, I mean, there's so many retellings now, and they're all lovely, but I feel like there's not a lot of YA, and maybe it's that I'm not paying as much attention to YA, but maybe it's just because there's a lack. And if the story of a girl who finds out that her father is actually her brother and her mother is actually her grandmother also, they're both, you know, if that isn't fit for a YA novel, I don't know what is. This episode also features probably some of the hardest I've ever laughed into the microphone, for similar reasons to the whole Oedipus of it all. I'm going to let you wait not so patiently for that moment. It was such a joy talking to Megan and hearing all about this book. And yeah, I hope you all sit back and enjoy this love letter to Thebes in the form of a conversation about a novel. Conversations, novelizing the best ancient city-state, Riddles of the Sphinx with Megan Cleveland. I would love to hear about your book and Thebes, and like, I know I'm only saying Thebes, I recognize it's about specific people in Thebes, but you know me, I just fucking love Thebes, so yeah.
I know.
So I just want to hear everything, but yeah, tell me about your, you know, whatever you want to share about your characters and your novel and
Sure. So I wrote a little introduction just to remind people who I am, because
yes,
it's been a while since they heard from me. So my name's Megan Cleveland. I have a BA in Classical Studies and Classical Languages from the University of Guelph and an MA in Classics from the University of Western Ontario. And since graduating, I decided to pursue my lifelong dream of becoming an author, using my knowledge of classical history, literature, and archaeology to adapt classical myths for young adults. And I'm so happy to talk to you about my upcoming self-published book on the podcast. Literally, I was rewriting this book, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago and listening to your podcast and thinking, wouldn't it be so great if I could talk to Lev? And here we are. So
yay.
This is like such a good moment. So
I love it because like YA too. I mean, I know there's some YA. Well, there's definitely a lot, but like I feel like a lot of them are adult. And like there's also this habit of like calling adult books that are written primarily for women, calling them YA. So I also love to have one that is like, no, this is YA. Like, because there should be YA too. And also we should not call all books written for women YA. It's a great distinction.
I've always loved YA. And I think a lot of Greek myths really lend themselves well to that sort of genre because it's a lot about self-discovery and finding out who you are and like family secrets. So I think it really works out for young people.
Speaking of family secrets, though, like I also think you have like the best character for YA but also family secrets.
Oh, yeah. So I'll just give a little description of the book before I start ranting about it.
Please.
So in Riddles of the Sphinx, Ismene, the daughter of the legendary Oedipus, refuses to be a background character in the tragedy of her family. Ismene makes a wager with Apollo, the god who cursed her family, agreeing to go into his service if she cannot stop the war between her brothers. Ismene must travel all across ancient Greece to learn the source of her family curse and try to break it before war severs her family forever. But in a family at war with itself, is she destined to be the only survivor?
I mean, well, mythologically, we got some stuff to say. Oh, I love that. I mean, like, just all the families in Thebes, obviously, are my favorite. But, like, I just love the story of, like, the line of Oedipus so much. I feel like there is – it's so interesting because our primary – you know, sort of the most famous source is like Sophocles, right? But like, we don't know what he was changing from the myths that he was working off of because we don't really have what came before him, which I'm just kind of obsessed with when it comes to this myth because it was huge. It was so important. And yet like all we have is this play, which as people know, it's just like movies adapting history. Like we don't know what they changed. Like there's a Napoleon movie out right now and I bet you it's bonkers. So like Sophocles could be wild. Like, so I mean, this is me, like, I also, you know, focus on the myths, obviously. But I'm so curious kind of how you wanted to work with that, you know, given the sourcing and, like, what you wanted your characters to be like in their story. And, like, yeah, like, what were your goals and thoughts and schemes and whatever. I don't know how to form questions well. I just, end up finishing them in the most bizarre ways.
That is the perfect question, though, because it has been such a journey to get from where I started to where it is now. I first started writing the book in 2017 for NaNoWriMo, and I went on a trip in June, and I read The Song of Achilles, and that was just like life-defining moment. Just because the writing's so beautiful, but I looked at Madeline Miller's bio and I was like, this could be me. I could be doing this. Why aren't I doing this? So then I thought I could write a Greek myth retelling myself. So I sat down and thought about it. And during undergrad and grad school, one of the myths that you keep reading over and over and over is Oedipus the King and Antaeus. So like, I know those back to front. So I thought, okay, I can work with those. So I started the process of writing by just rereading those plays. And I also reread Statius's The Baiad, which I talked about in our last episode together, which I read in grad school. And I read the translations and like parts in the original Greek and Latin just to like get a vibe for it. And This is kind of funny, but when I started out, I was going to write the book from Antigone's point of view, but I don't actually like Antigone very much.
Same.
She's kind of a bitch, but you know.
I think she's just like so overrated. Like, I don't like to say that about a woman, but I think that Antigone is the perfect example of that. Like, because I think that Antigone is kind of like, she gives me like kind of like Athena vibes. Like, I feel like she has become so big because she fits into the patriarchy in a way that makes men comfortable. And so she became this like big woman of myth. But like, yeah, I mean, comparatively to like everybody else, she's a lot less interesting. Like, I love working with the other sister, the forgotten sister.
That's such a good point you just made, because it is a woman, the perfect woman written by a man. So that's why we don't like her.
Yeah, that's but, the thing.
So then I thought, okay, Antigone has her own play. Eteocles and Polynices have their own thing. But what about Ismene? She just kind of gets mentioned. She doesn't have her own story. So I thought, what's her story? So the first round of writing that I did, I was really like focused on trying to make it as historically accurate as possible, which now I think, what a stupid idea that was. But I really wanted to like capture this Bronze Age Greece and have all these like archaeological details and like try to make it as true to the history as I knew it. But like, we know that in Greek history, they place a lot of limits on the rights and movements of women. So a lot of my feedback was, she's the main character, but she's not very active, or doesn't really have any agency. So I thought, okay, well, this is true to Greece at the time, but they were right. And one of the ways I tried to get around that was by having her be a seer. So she could see the events unfolding as they happened through her dreams, but not actually be participating in them. And this is going to come up again later. So we're going to remember Ismene as a seer. And so I wrote that book, tried to make it as historically accurate as I could, sent it out to people to read. They sent me their feedback. I fixed it, sent it out to agents, got rejected. And then I took a writing class, workshopped it. And then I got to go to this writing festival called the Fold Festival of Literary Diversity in Brampton.
I know people, well, I used to know people who started that, I think, like because when I was working in book publishing, I remember that starting up. That's so exciting.
Yeah, it's a really, really great festival, especially for like marginalized writers. You can go and talk to people in the industry. And I got to speak to a literary agent there. And she told me the problem with the book, which my friends had been too nice to tell me. And the problem was, she said it so in a way that made so perfect sense to my neurodivergent brain. That's where so she helpful. Said, I get what you're trying to do. You're trying to write a Greek myth, but what you want to do is write in response to it. And I thought, you're right. That's what I want to do. So from that point, I scrapped the 75,000 words that I already wrote and wrote it from the beginning. And this time I was like, screw historically accurate. Like, if my audience is young adults, they're not going to know all this. It's not my colleagues from grad school, my professors reading this. This is going to be teenagers, and they want to read something fun. So when I started out, I thought, what got me into classics in the first place? And that, like a lot of people, was Disney's Hercules.
Damn right.
Which is just such a fun, colorful, magical, funny movie. And that's what draws a lot of people to Greek mythology, is just like the magic and the monsters and the gods in their relationships to humans. So that's what I wanted to focus on. And one part of the first draft of the book was, it started out with all of Oedipus's children when they're very young and when the plague first falls on Thebes. So they watch Oedipus try to figure out who the murderer of Laius is, and they play a game where they try to figure it out. And people really liked that. And the agent even did. And she said, but it would have been cool if you kept that for the whole book. And I thought, okay, that's what I'm going to do. So in this version, the finished version, Ismene doesn't know what happened to her parents. She thinks they're both dead. And she doesn't know everything that happened. Mm-hmm. So she goes on this journey to uncover the truth about her family and the curse on her line, and how that's attributing to the generational violence with her brothers. So I really took, I really copy pasted of that paper I wrote for grad school, but made it a novel about cursed families in Greece, and how when she travels throughout Greece, she gets hints about her own family curse along the way.
So does that mean you, we, sorry, now I'm in my favorite cursed family mode. Do you talk about like the, never even know which one to call it because they're so cursed. But you know, the Thyestes family?
Yes. Hell, there's, yeah. So these, there's a scene with Thyestes, and I took a lot of inspiration from Lord of the Rings.
Fuck yes.
Yes, you know the part in The Two Towers where they go to Rohan and Théoden is kind of being hidden behind Grima Wormtongue? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like that moment. Thyestes is on his little throne, and he's like, why are you here, Tiresias? So it's, I took some inspiration from Tolkien for that.
I'm loving that. I can absolutely see Théoden, Thyestes. Like, there's, yeah, there's like, there's something there. I love it.
I will give you a hint, but I'll try to make it as vague as possible for people who end up reading the book. Before, I had them come to Mycenae after the events of a certain feast, but I decided it would be more emotional if it if they were there at the feast. So it gets a bit, my sister read it and went, this is gross, it's awesome. So hopefully people like it.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Yeah, it's, I love, one of my favorite things about retellings and when people do this is, and what I'm trying to do on my own, is like incorporating lots of little mythological references throughout, like whether they are long and detailed or they're just little bits and pieces, because like they're so much and they're so interconnected, and like how fun to have things that, you know, can be obvious, like the Feast of Thyestes, which I... Seneca's Thyestes might be my favorite thing in the world now. but like, you know, or like little tiny little Easter eggs where somebody's like, hey, that name is interesting, or that like vague reference is interesting. Like, why don't I look it up? And then they learn this whole new myth, like, especially, excuse me, especially for YA. Like, that's so great. It's such a great introduction for people to find other books as well, you know, or other mythology. Mm-hmm. And like, I love that. So like, was, I want to make sure I let you talk about all of the things you want to talk about. But like, were there, did you do a lot of that? Did you, you know, seek to kind of like include a lot of little myths, or were you more focused on the larger story?
So the first version of the book, I had a lot of little myths where they tell each other stories, because there was a subplot of her weaving this tapestry of all the stories her brother told her before he turned kind of evil. But but in this, she doesn't really know things. She kind of uncovers them along the way, and she actually gets to meet the people. So on her journey, the first place she goes to is Argos, and she gets to meet Adrastus, who's the king of Argos at the time, and that's where her brother Polynices is. He doesn't recognize her because she's doing a Mulan and is dressed as a boy at the time.
Love
but
that.
she learns about Tantalus while she's there, because Tantalus is the famous ancestor of Adrastus, and he makes a really big deal out of it. And she's like, why? He's a terrible guy. You don't want to be associated with him. So she learns along the way about problems between fathers and sons and brothers, and oh, how does this apply to my own family? I don't know.
Yeah. I love that, because that's the thing about mythology or Greek mythology. Like, it is so cyclical, and also like it mirrors so many other different things. Like, yeah, like these family curses and then the fathers and relationships. But I love that you had that reference to Tantalus, because one of my favorite things about reading about that family, which is just my favorite curse in the world, is that no matter how horrifying like the next bit is in that curse line, they're always like, we are the children of Tantalus. Did he try to eat his son? Sure. Are we still proud to be the children of Tantalus? Like, hell yeah. And then it's like Agamemnon and Menelaus are like, we are the sons of Atreus. And it's like, did Atreus kill his nephews and feed them to his brother? Sure. We are the proud sons of Atreus. Like, I just love that it's like, we will learn no lessons. We will always honor our fathers no matter what they did. Like, it just, yeah, it feels so legit.
That's so funny. There's a part in Statius's The Bayad, which is partially based on, where Polynices actually has some self-awareness and he doesn't want to tell people who his father is because he's embarrassed. He doesn't want to be associated with that stigma. So
I think that Oedipus is the one that,
it's kind of worse than just eating your son, I guess.
We think about it now and you're like, which one's worse? Like, I don't think that Oedipus's situation is inherently worse, but I love that. Yeah. Like in the ancient world, it was like, no, we're not proud to be the children of Oedipus, but like Atreus, Thyestes, or like Atreus or Tantalus, like that's totally fine. Like, I love that there was this line of like, well, but he married his mom. It's like, you sacrificed babies and fed them to his son. Like, which is worse, really?
Yeah, I think a part of it also is like, Atreus and Thyestes were very aware of what they were doing to each other. So that, and Oedipus, he didn't know about his own parentage. So it's kind of a different situation for him. So yeah, it's a bit interesting that he kind of has more guilt because he didn't kind of talk himself out of what he was going to do, like Atreus.
I know, and it's just interesting because it's like, to us, that would make him so much less guilty. He had no idea he was marrying his mother. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, it's like, no, that's the embarrassment, not these guys that did horrible things very on purpose. Oh, it's just, it's so interesting. Sorry, like, I'm like, this is what happens with these ones, is that I just go to the mythology and I'm like, oh my God, but you just pointed out something interesting about all these random myths that is not necessarily the purpose of your novel.
No. I think it's important. Like, a lot of those myths have in common is with cannibalism in these myths.
I love Greek mythology to just be, you can just so cleanly be like, with cannibalism, and I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, that's perfectly normal topic, but it's kind of symbolically this similar situation to Oedipus. It's like the image of the Ouroboros, a snake eating its tail. If you eat your children, they're going back to where they came from, and you're ending your own line. So that's what's happening with
your
both
mom, like, it's the same kind of,
it's the same thing. You're going back to where you came from, literally. Oh god.
Thank you. That might be one of my all-time favorite podcast moments. Where you came from?
That's what Freud says, but whatever.
No, you're not wrong. You are not wrong.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency, where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. on demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
You deserve a moment to yourself every single day. And a delicious bite of a Keebler Sandies can give you that comforting pause. Don't forget to pack the melt-in-your-mouth magic of a Keebler Sandies for a post-lunch pick-me-up. This magic is baked into simple shortbread cookies by Ernie and the Keebler Elves. So as life continues to fly by, make the most of your me moment. Take a pause and enjoy a Keebler Sandies.
Okay, that's literal perfect transition, because like you're writing this YA book about this girl, and like, you know, I know you probably want to watch with too many spoilers, but like you're writing this YA book about a girl discovering her family, but the end discovery is that like her dad is also her brother and her mom is also her grandmother. Like how did you want to navigate that? Like how much did you want to kind of, you know, make it for a younger audience, or like, you know, what was your thought process there? Because it's a lot.
It is a lot. For a long time, I was like, should I just gloss over the incest? I do mention it. Like, you have to, because that's it's a very famous story. But she's not so much focused on the incest as much as her family, like the curse of her dad committing patricide, and how that kind of stained his relationships with his son, and then her brothers are going to go on to commit fratricide. So she sees, especially through all of these other cursed families, how all these conflicts between fathers and sons and brother and brother, and how it could lead to violence. And she kind of wants to take those lessons and change what happens. But yeah, it was really hard to try to like talk about incest in a YA book, which is probably why all these agents were like, oh, no thanks. But
but I do like my least favorite thing about Greek mythology retellings is when people just feel the need to like pretend that the myth is like much more sanitized than it was, you know?
Yeah.
Like the truth, the myth is there, but I also think it's really also realistic to have Ismini be more focused on the patricide, because like, you know, for all it's horrible, like, I mean, my favorite theory on Oedipus and Jocasta collectively is that the tragedy isn't so much the actual marriage and incest. The tragedy is that they didn't know, and that like in my head they were really happy family.
Yeah.
And then this shit came out. And so I like that, because I like to think that a daughter wouldn't, you know, and stop me if this changes and you don't want me to say it, but like I like the idea that the daughter, if she found that out, wouldn't immediately like find her parents disgusting. You know, like it's just like that shit happened, and like, yeah, I don't think it has to color, you know, your relationship with your parents, despite it being kind of wild to think about.
Yeah, I tried to explore that more in the first version, but in this one, I'm like, you know what? There's a war going on. They're literally going to kill each other tomorrow. So she's like, okay, I got to focus on the more important part, which is breaking the curse. Let's not think about my mom and dad or brother or whatever he is. Let's just keep going.
Yeah, and that's reasonable too. That's practical if you've got your brothers fighting right outside your window.
And it's just a lot of, it's just not fair. I think that's what she kind of thinks, is like her current generation's being punished for what her father did. Her father's being punished for what his father did. So there's just these cycles of violence, and when does it stop? So that's what she's trying to achieve, is trying to change that course of fate from happening, because we don't want to keep reliving all these cycles of violence just because they happened before.
Yeah. Well, and if, you know, there's really good examples of of the family, you know, like Thyestes, like it just goes on and on and on. Like I just yesterday had the last episode in my series on Iphigenia among the Taurians, which is like, you know, some of the final blows of that family and their curse and like just the absurd things that keep happening because yeah, no one's trying to break it. So I love the idea of being like, if I don't stop this, like it will just go on forever. And so, you know, do what I can kind of thing.
There's a part in the book where she's at the feast and Atreus is kind of bustling around and he's all excited to have the feast get ready. We know why, but she doesn't. And she's kind of taking this as like, oh, this is great. Look at these brothers reconcile. Maybe I can learn from them and help reconcile my own brothers. So when she finds out what Atreus had done, she's so angry and she has this conversation with Apollo about it. Because she's like, they had the chance to just to end this feud, but it's just going to keep going. Is this what it's going to happen to my family? So,
yeah.
But of course, the gods, they can't tell you what to do. You have to figure it yourself.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they wouldn't anyway.
But no.
They're big dicks. So, great. Speaking of the gods, did you, I mean, with this family, it's not, you know, it's not really necessary. But did you include like, that aspect of mythology that's more like a direct kind of connection with the divine or the, you know, what did you want to do with the gods?
Right. So, okay, here's where it gets a little interesting. Great. So in my first version, I had decided that Ismene should be a seer because of plot reasons. And I started out with her, she hears Apollo's voice in her mind, but she doesn't know it's Apollo. It's just this voice telling her what to do. And she's like, just leave me alone. So he makes her leave the women's quarters, which she's never done before. Because in this version of Thebes, she's told by her nurse and her brothers that the plague is still ongoing and it's not safe to go outside. So this voice leads her outside and she realizes it is safe. And what else are they lying to me about? And she soon realizes that the voice is Apollo and that he'll give her more answers if she goes to Delphi to meet him. And it just so happens that the Thebans are going to go to Delphi for the Pythian Games. So this is where she gets the idea to do a Mulan and join the delegation as a boy.
Oh my God, I love that.
To watch her cousins and her brothers participate. And
are they so naked?
I didn't explicitly say, but we know that the Greek athletes were naked, so
great.
You could your headcanon they could be naked.
Perfect. I saw a good meme today where it's just like all adaptations are like
there's not enough clothes. Dicks. I've seen that same one.
Yeah, there's not enough dicks. This is not real ancient Greece.
So while she's there, she meets the Oracle at Delphi, and a lot of people who study Greek myth know Oracle Delphi is the most famous oracle in ancient Greece, but it's not the only one. Mm-hmm. Some of the others like that we know of are the Oracle at Dodona for Zeus. But it turns out, in my second round of writing, I decided to do a deep dive into all the history of Thebes. Even though I wasn't trying to stay as historically accurate, I wanted that image of what Thebes was like in my head. Mm-hmm. And I discovered that there was an oracle in Thebes to the god Apollo Ismenius.
Oh, yeah. Like, there was an oracle. Because I know of, like, there's a temple to Apollo Ismenus because of the, like, stream that ran by that called that.
But there was a whole oracle dedicated by the stream. And I kind of explained it in the book. The stream Ismenius is named for a son of Apollo. He had a son with a nymph there. There's actually a poem about it by Pindar. And Pindar tells us a lot about the oracle at Apollo Ismenius as well, mm-hmm. because he was a proud Theban. But this oracle was famous for telling the future through pyromancy, so they would look into the fire. So I was like, what the fuck? So I reread Sophocles, and there's all these little like hints that I had not noticed because I didn't know this before. So when Tiresias goes to give his prophecies, he doesn't just deliver them. He looks into the fire, even though he doesn't have eyes. He looks into the fire because that's that association with the city, right? And there's a beautiful line from the Robert Fagles translation where he says, where the embers glow and die and Apollo sees the future and the ashes. And I was like, okay, this is important. So I kind of wanted Asmini as a seer being a precursor to this oracle being set up, which isn't really historical.
That's fine.
I'm just throwing it out there for fun.
But that is so many things happening here in my head. One, for all that I think everyone, you know, who wants to should write mythological retellings, I absolutely love talking to classicists who have written mythological retellings because I think that there is a deeper level of nerdery afoot. Like talking to you is like being in my brain when I've been working on my current novel, you know, of just, oh my God, I found this super cool, ridiculously niche, like absurdly niche historical fact. And I get to write it in, and will anybody really know what I've done? Probably not, but I'll know, you know, like, I love that. Like, there is definitely a different level with like just the depth of like ancient source nerdery. And nerdery is an official word, I will say. But also, like, where was the other thought? I think it was mostly that. Like, I love that. Like, that's so interesting. Oh, but that's what was the other thought. Is that you, like, that's a great thing about novels, is that you can take this historical thing and you can write it into yours and like make it what you want. And so you're like, yeah, you're blending this like really accurate niche historical detail with your own story in this really unique and creative way. You're getting me excited for my own novel. Thank you. I'm already taking notes.
That's so great. And I was even more excited because Sophocles himself backed me up. So I was like, thank God, yeah. Sophocles. So during school, I read Oedipus the King and Antigone more times than I can count, but I had never read Oedipus at Colonus. I read it the first time when I was researching this book.
Yeah, I've never read it either, and I've read the other two.
Okay, so Asmini has more of a role in that book than she does in any other. So it starts with Oedipus and Antigone are kind of wandering around. You know those images that we have of Antigone leading him around and he's got his hand on her shoulder. Yeah. So they're traveling and she says, oh, somebody's riding toward us. There's a rider and they're coming straight this way. Oh my God, it's Asmini, it's my sister. So then you find out that Asmini, she secretly leaves the palace to bring news to Oedipus and Antigone. And the news she brings is oracles specifically about him. So I'm like, okay, Sophocles set this up for me. What if she was making the oracles herself? So that's where I went, and I just took off from there.
That is the most satisfying thing to find, though.
Like, yeah.
Oh, I have such similar things, like, not direct examples coming to mind, but I know that feeling so well of, like, having this idea, being really excited about it, and then finding a source where you're like, holy shit. Like,
I was right.
It works. Yeah. Like, I can back it up. I don't even have to totally fake it. Like, I can back it up. Oh, that's so fun. Also, so cool that, like, I mean, obviously the plays always feature, you know, more women than like a lot of other kind of content. But, like, I love that something about her riding a horse and being by herself really stands out to me. Being like, I'm going to do this on my own. I'm a woman. I am, like, doing this. Tell my family. Like, that's badass.
And Sophocles says a very un-Sophoclean thing to me, where Oedipus says to his two daughters that they're more like, they have more agency than their brothers because they go out and they do things, whereas their brothers sit at home and wait for things to happen. And I thought, this is amazing. This is proof that she can leave the palace and go on this adventure. So I was like, thank you, Sophocles.
Yes. I do think that's the thing that, though, the difference, I would say, between anybody, just a general nerd writing versus people who are as steeped in the ancient sources, is that I also think people like us feel like we need that.
Yeah. We need validation.
Yeah, like, you can fictionalize anything. You can write anything you want into your novel, but I totally also know that feeling of being like, no, I can do this because Sophocles said I could. Where you're like, you could have done it anyway. But no. I needed him.
In 2018, I went to a book signing and got to talk to Madeline Miller while she signed my book. And I said, look, I'm writing this book. And like you, I did my master's in classics. And how do you get past thinking about your professors reading the book? She goes, I had the same problem. Just don't make it as good as you can. And don't tell them about it until it's already out. And I said, okay, that's a good plan. So So I have all these ghosts over my shoulder, like all my professors and Sophocles and Euripides are like, you can't do that. But I'm like, screw it. I'm going to write what I want.
Euripides would never tell you you can't do
that. You know what? You're right. Euripides is a better man.
He knows that you can do whatever you want. You can make it wild and he loves you for it.
You know what? He was part of my aha moment where I was like, it doesn't have to be super historical. It doesn't have to be true to the sources because there is no original source. Like, myths are always evolving. They're always changing. That's what is so wonderful about them, because they're always changing the story because of who's telling them. So I was like, Euripides is also blessing me to do what I want. So here we go.
I mean, he made Helen an Eidolon, and he made Iphigenia like a priestess of Artemis killing people in Taurus. Like, you know, he knows it. He's like, I did whatever the fuck I want. Why can't you? Like,
yeah.
That's the thing. I think people forget or just it's not brought to attention, I think, enough if you're not in really in deep in this realm. Like, if you're just picking up any of these books, like, it's so easy to think about a quote-unquote original myth or to even think that, like, you know, that say Oedipus the King is, you know, the sort of formative, like, the version of Oedipus because it's the one that everyone thinks about. But, mm-hmm. like, I mean, not only is it just a play, but it's being a play, it is fan fiction. Like, it is, yes. Sophocles working with whatever he had and writing the story that he wanted to write just like anyone else. And that is so interesting. And, like, that's why I love plays, because they are from the ancient world, but at the same time, they are reception just like your novel is reception. And so you get to look at them in that way. And it's, yeah, like, it's so much more interesting to see them that way. And then, like, I think it's much more inspirational too, to like people writing.
Yeah. And I think it's more worthwhile to not try to just say the same thing like I was before, as Sophocles and Statius said, but to take what they wrote and try to make it relevant to me. So yeah, that's what I did.
Yeah, I love that. Like, did you play a lot with her relationship with Antigone, or were you just kind of like, Antigone's been done?
Okay, so this is it annoys me, but in my head, Ismene is basically me. Like, she's just this shy girl, and she kind of gets out of her comfort zone and tries to make things right. Antigone, I'm writing, I just write things that I didn't think about. It's like she's talking through me, and I'm like, oh my god. Like, she really surprises me the way that she interacts, because my Antigone is very aware that this should be her story, so she's kind of resentful that Ismene is the main character. They even have a discussion at the end where she says, you know, I would have thought you would be the one that was left behind, not me. So I just had, like, first she goes through the, you know, the five stages, like, she denies that she's not the main character, and then she comes to accept it, and she helps Ismene on her journey, basically.
That feels so Antigone, like, just so, yeah. Completely. I mean, it's Sophocles' fault, but it does feel, yeah, very, very Antigone. I love that. Did you read The Phoenician Women for this?
I did, and I read, what's the other one called? The Aeschylus one.
Oh, the East. Oh, Seven Against Thebes.
Yeah, I read those two as well, but I hadn't read them as many times as Sophocles, so that's the one that really stuck out in my head.
Yeah,
but even
no,
just
it's fair, yeah.
Those three contemporary sort of, like, Sophocles, Euripides, and Aeschylus, they write so many different versions of the same stories. So I was like, it doesn't matter what I do, because they've already set up this precedent of changing myths. So I'm gonna keep going with that.
Well, it reminds me, so I've had a conversation that has not aired yet, but will have aired by the time this one airs. Oh, it's inceptioning. but this part did not appear in it, because it's for a future conversation. Anyway, basically, I have this plan for future episode series, probably not until next summer, so it's ages away, but I'm going to just, something new and different for me, I'm just going to do Euripides. But I want to look at, like, him more as a person and, like, how it all happened. And I was speaking to Toph Marshall, who's going to be on to talk about just theater broadly, but he made some comments about Euripides that made me go, okay, you're coming back on the show, like, later when we're doing this, because I'm going to forget the details, but there's this whole, you know, kind of tradition around these stories and like what we accept as sort of, you know, facts and truth and original myth, like we were saying. And, you know, and it is Sophocles's, right? Like Sophocles's Oedipus, the king, is like sort of the definitive Oedipus. I mean, it's mostly because it's the one that survives. But like, why is it the one that survives? And so, you know, because Oedipus, or not Oedipus, Euripides also wrote an Oedipus. And I forget what the detail was, but Toph told me that like basically there was like he had written in this like very big difference to Sophocles's. Like, I don't know if it was like Oedipus didn't bind himself or some big change that, you know, just kind of his version and this change like all just kind of got forgotten completely. And I just think that's it's so interesting to think about like how these versions become canon, because like no one in the ancient world was like Sophocles is more correct than Euripides. Like, they were probably like, we like this play better, but they weren't out there being like, this is the wrong myth, because they understood how myth worked in a way that it's harder for us now. But I just, yeah, I love that idea. Like, I'm not even forming this into a relation to your book, I realize, but like, I just, I think it's so interesting, but I also think it does lend itself to fiction broadly, right? Like you were saying, there is no right or wrong myth. There is no original myth. There is no, like, I mean, there are some things where you're like, that has no basis in myth, sure.
Yeah.
But there is no, like, you know, wrong version in terms of, like, the things that do survive. It's just so fun. I'm just like, so full of, like, ancient source thoughts in my brain.
Yeah. I'm not sure how it was in Greece, but in ancient Rome, part of a Roman boy's education was in oratory and in law would be doing these practice speeches where you would take a mythological subject and you would try to argue it from one character's point of view or the other. So you could try to be defend Helen's actions, or you could defend Paris's actions, and the points that you got, or the way you kind of revolutionized the myth and not sticking to like a current story. So even the ancients were taught like myths are fluid, you can change them to get what you want out of them, basically.
Yes. Oh, I love that. That's really interesting. It makes me think of Ovid, you know, like,
yeah,
he went and he took all these predominantly Greek stories and he was like, I'm gonna kind of mess with things, and like, we are still paying the price in a lot of ways. Like, I think purely of Medusa, it's this really common idea that that Ovid's version is like the Medusa now. And it bums me out. Like, I really like to stick to I love Ovid, but like, something about Medusa, I'm like, I want the Greek. I mean, a big part of it is that like Ovid introduced this Athena villain story that I think is so unnecessary. And like, that's stuck in this way where people are like, either, you know, Athena is the villain, or they're like, oh, but maybe Athena blessed her and saved her. And I'm like, I don't like that either. No. Like, it's all gross to me in a modern context. I love Ovid for what he did, but I hate that the people have like latched onto this as like, this is Medusa's story. Cause I'm like, it is objectively not. Like, if we're really talking about ancient sources, the Romans were out here making wild changes. And that's such a great example that young Roman boys were taught that, like, fuck with the myth and you can like win at this contest. Like, that's so interesting, and it so screams Ovid, which is a great source, but like, not if we're talking about Greek myths, then it's not.
It's funny you say that, because I basically figured that out because I was doing my graduate research on Ovid. So I like had to write this really big research paper. It wasn't a thesis. We didn't do a thesis-based MA, it was course-based, and in between the 2 years, you did a major research paper. So mine was on Ovid, and particularly on book 13 of the Metamorphoses, but I wanted to talk about like his early life and his education. So Ovid's father, I think, was a lawyer, and he wanted Ovid to be a lawyer as well. So he did have that training in those and that schooling. So he was used to and trained to twist those myths. So that's something that people should keep in mind. He's not telling us this concrete myth. He's telling us what he wants to.
Yeah. And I love him because I think that's absolutely valid. But what I hate is when people are like, but that's the version. I'm like, no, it's Ovid's version.
Yeah, that is Ovid's version.
And there's nothing wrong with Ovid's version, but it's not. Like, it's not the Greek version, objectively speaking, for a lot of reasons. Yeah, that's so interesting to know, though. I love that fact. Yeah.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
You deserve a moment to yourself every single day. And a delicious bite of a Keebler Sandies can give you that comforting pause. Don't forget to pack the melt-in-your-mouth magic of a Keebler Sandies for a post-lunch pick-me-up. This magic is baked into simple shortbread cookies by Ernie and the Keebler Elves. So as life continues to fly by, make the most of your me moment. Take a pause and enjoy a Keebler Sandies.
Without me having a specific question, like, what are some fun things that you like learned about or that you wanted to write into this book? Or like, I don't know, I just want to hear more, but my brain is not coming up with a specific question to ask you. Do you have thoughts?
Right. So I really got off on a tangent about the Oracle of Ismene.
Oh, yes.
Ismene and Apollo.
Where we started?
Yeah, but...
Neurodivergence, talking together.
Exactly. But I became a bit obsessed with that. I lose focus a lot. So by becoming hyper-focused on other things.
Uh-huh, yeah, same.
So I did some research and I found out there's a school in the States that is currently doing an excavation on the... the temple. So I found out who was doing it and I emailed them. I was like, I'd like to ask you some questions. Can we like hop on Zoom? So I had a little Zoom meeting with them, and then because their research isn't published yet, they weren't actually allowed to talk about their research, but they gave me some really good primary sources to look to. Mm. So Pausanias has like his, you know, his travel guide to ancient Greece, and he talks about Thebes and the temple. So that was really helpful because the temple does make an appearance at the end of the book. Yeah. They told me about a book that I'll have to type it out and send it to you because I cannot spell it for the life of me without looking at a reference. But there is a classicist named Cerantes Simeonoglu, who wrote A Topography of Thebes. It's this massive book that covers Thebes from the Bronze Age up until like modern Thebes, like in the 80s or the 90s. So you see how the city grows over time and you learn about the history and the geography and the politics. And it's just such a great resource to have, especially if you're looking at Thebes in particular. So I was obsessed with that book. I took it out of the special collections library at the university and I had it in my room for like 3 months because I didn't want to let it go. It was so helpful.
Oh, I love that. I love finding stuff like that. I mean, and just Pausanias is so fun and helpful for like those little things of like just describing a thing. Like, sure, he's late, whatever, but he's like the eyes on the ground in a way that we don't have otherwise. Like, thank fuck for Pausanias.
Yeah, and even though he's seeing these things so much later than we want to write about them, it is nice to have like a firsthand account of what it would look like in situ kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
And it's better than nothing.
It is better than nothing. Exactly. It gives you an idea. Another thing that was helpful for me, I know not everybody's in the position to do it, but my husband got funding to go to Greece and I went with him and
oh shucks.
It was great. He was studying these stone tablets at Delphi. So he was in like the archives looking at them and I was just wandering around. And I took a lot of inspiration just from being at Delphi for the book. And especially there's certain artifacts that I saw there that are in the book and that are important. So when Ismene looks into like the fire and has her visions, she sees these images speaking to her, images that she saw on the Sacred Way. So we've got the famous Naxian Sphinx. I wrote this scene where the Sphinx kind of shakes off the marble and becomes the actual Sphinx and flies down to talk to her. And there's also the statues of Cleobus and Meton. You know, those, the two, they're kind of like two Kuroi standing together.
Yeah, I was going to say they're like really archaic stuff, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they were a dedication to the Sacred Way, but for the purposes of my book, they're actually Atreus and Thyestes. And then there's this monumental cauldron. And when I saw it, I'm like, that's where Tantalus stewed Pelops because it's enormous. So I had that cauldron kind of hops over because it has lion's feet and tries to like swallow her whole. So I kind of took inspiration from things that I saw while I was there. So you can find a lot of inspiration.
Yeah. But I also love like what you're describing, that like one of the things I think that it also I feel like should be in more retellings is more of that fantasy, like Greek mythology. When you're writing it that way, like, is fantasy. And I think a lot of people want to make it real and really down to earth, and I respect that entirely. Yeah. I personally want the fantasy. Like, I want the gods interacting with shit. I want like wild stuff happening. Like, I also just love the idea that you had Atreus cook a couple of children at Delphi. Like, that's another level to the crime that you're adding in a way that I respect it.
Yeah, he did some stuff. And
he did some stuff.
I really wanted, because I was thinking about when I was a kid and I was into Greek mythology because of Hercules. It was the magic that I was into. Yes. So I'm trying to make this as magical as I can. And there's one part where I thought I went too far, and I'll tell you about it. So she's been traveling across Greece for weeks. She's dirty and scrumped. Like, she's got dirty clothes on. She's cut her hair off to be a boy. And her and Apollo are getting ready to return to Thebes so she can have her big moment in the palace with the rest of the Thebans. And Apollo says to her, you can't go back to Thebes looking like that. And he kind of makes her look like a princess again. And as I was writing it, I thought, you can't do this. Apollo isn't a fairy godmother. Like, this is stupid.
Why not?
And then I remembered, Liv, I actually have a precedent for this in Homer, when in the Odyssey, when Nausicaa finds Odysseus when she's playing with her friends, Athena makes him look more beautiful to her. So I was like, okay, yes. I have a precedent for this. So Apollo is just as much of a fairy godmother as Athena was to Odysseus. So there I was taking my inspiration from the ancients again.
Yeah, so yeah, you had a precedent. You found the precedent in Athena. I love that because also, like, it just you even saying that, I got so many other memories of the Odyssey because, like, there's so many moments where Athena comes in and she's like, I'm going to make you look a totally different way because it's like, yeah, for Nausicaa, it's, you know, she wants him to be beautiful. When he goes home to Ithaca, he's got to be
a beggar.
Man, yeah. There's so many different things like that. And I'm just wondering, like, I imagine the Iliad must have some of those as well. But I love that. Like, I mean, the gods really can do whatever you want them to do.
Yeah, and for the gods, like, humans are their playthings, kind of, so.
That's how all Greek myth retellings should see it. Thank you.
So basically, in that moment, she's a Barbie doll for Apollo.
I love this because I've been working on a totally new novel this year, and Apollo is my absolute villain. Like, he is the worst of them. He's absolutely the worst. But I do like seeing, like, I mean, that's the other thing about Greek myth is that, like, the gods contain multitudes. Like, they are so often the fucking worst to some people and then really lovely to another. So there's just, you know, it all checks out. Like, whatever you or anybody else wants to write with these gods, like, you can probably make it work. Like, they're really, you know, they are just so many things at once. And that's why they're fun.
There's a scene, like, it happened. I didn't plan Antigone to say this. She just said this of her own volition, where Ismene reveals to her she's been hearing this voice in her head, and it's Apollo, and that he wants her to go to Delphi. And Antigone says to her, think, when has a god being interested in a human ever ended up a good thing for the human? You have to be careful. And Ismene never thought that before. So I was like, okay, Antigone, thank you for putting that out there for her.
Yeah, and it's so valid. And, like, I mean, that is the thing I love about Greek myth that's what I want in my retellings. It's what I've written into mine is that, like, yeah, the gods are fucking dangerous. Like, that is Greek mythology in a nutshell. The gods are dangerous. Their interactions with mortals rarely go well. Certainly, as we all know, like, going to the oracle in mythology is rarely a good idea. Mm-hmm. Some bad shit always happens. And so, yeah, like, I love that. I mean, and at the same time, like, Apollo can be good to the people he wants to be good to. I cannot think of any examples off the top of my head, but I'm sure they exist. But didn't he, like, set his mother on fire first?
That's true.
Like,
she was having an affair. That's what the raven said, but.
Yeah, sure. Sure, raven.
But, you know, the gods, they do what they want for their own reasons. So Ismene's, like, she realizes she has Apollo's favor, but she's very wary of, like, okay, but when will I lose it? So I got to be careful when I have these interactions with him.
Yeah. Did you play with any of the other gods, or is Apollo kind of your main one?
Apollo's my main one. Athena makes a very brief appearance, but Apollo's basically the main one. Artemis comes into it, and the Fates. I had fun writing the Fates. They were great.
Did you conflate them with the Grey Eye, like in Hercules, just for fun?
No, I didn't. I had, at first I wanted to, because it would have made more sense plot-wise, and I was like, no, keep them separate.
I do. I mean, that's, I think, one of my favorite, like, major changes to myth and characters is just that the Grey Eye and the Moiré get to be the same three crones in Hercules, because it's just so much better that they share an eye.
And even in that way, they kind of get conflated with the Norn from Norse mythology.
Oh, do
the
they?
Three, yeah, because there's, so they kind of conflate them with other myths as well. And I was like, cool. Don't try not to do that. You've got enough myths to work with for this.
Yeah, fair. Valid. Oh, that's so fun. Okay, now that I've said Disney's Hercules, were you directly inspired by anything from Disney's Hercules? Or, I don't even know. I'm just curious about the Hercules of it all, because I also love that movie a lot.
I was inspired by Hercules because I wanted to approach the story with, like, sort of Disney magic, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I mentioned Mulan a couple times. So, like, there's parts of the book that I kind of thought of in regards to Disney movies, if that makes sense. So when she is drawn out of the women's quarters by Apollo, and she heads into the city, I was thinking of, you know, Princess Jasmine when she puts on the disguise and she goes out. And when she disguises herself as a boy, I was thinking of Mulan. So I was just trying to really keep that sense of, like, wonder and storytelling that you get in the classic Disney movies.
I love that. And I love that I can hear your cat right now.
Yeah, he's greeting my husband who just came in the door. That's Cosmo's podcast debut.
I love it. yeah, I mean, like, but I love, like, mythology is magic, you know? I think those inspirations work really well too. But really, like, mythology is magic. It is fantasy. And that's definitely my favorite thing to have in these retellings, is something that, like, really embraces that. Because, like, these weren't real people, and that's the fun. Like, that's the fun.
Yeah, it gives you a lot of freedom to put on characteristics of people you know, or characters you're familiar with, to these characters in myth, and to flesh them out some more.
Yeah. Ooh, how much traveling in Greece did you do? Like, I mean, I feel like if I was writing something where people get to travel, it would just be a shit show, because I'd be like, I want them to go literally everywhere, and then I have to think, like, logistically how possible that is. So I'm just curious, like, kind of if you had to hold yourself back, or, like, what you wanted to do with that.
Well, we were only there for a couple of days. We were there.
Oh, I mean your character, but I also want to hear about real life, actually, now that you say it.
So she basically reenacts things that I did on my trip. So this was just me reliving that trip. But so we were basically located in Athens for the majority of it, and we did some day trips. So we went to Corinth and Mycenae, we went to Delphi and Nafplio and Thebes. Oh god, that was the best day of my life.
I haven't been to Thebes. I've been to all of the I haven't really been to Corinth, I guess. I've been through Corinth, but, like, oh, I'm jealous about Thebes. I once accidentally drove through Thebes, but we didn't know we were there until we got to the sign that said you were leaving Theba. And I was like, son of a bitch. When I went there with like my friends in ancient history, fangirl, we drove to Delphi and back, and we took this, like, funny route back, whatever Google Maps gave us. And it took us, like, through this, like, very rural rig roundabout area. And we're like, mm-hmm. Oh, in a town. And then I was like, I'm curious where we are. And then literally we go to the, you know, they do the, like, they have, like, a cross through the word to say you're leaving that town. And I didn't realize we were in Thebes until it was just like, yeah, goodbye. Son of a bitch. I was just here and we didn't have time to go back. And so, yeah. Oh, my God. So how was Thebes? What did you see? Did you see the Cadmeion? I know that there's very little left. I'm so curious about everything.
I did. So going to Thebes, we went on the train and we thought, like, we got to the station. It was tough. When we got to the station,
they're wild.
It's completely empty. There's nothing there but this, like, skeletal dog. And we're like, oh God, what have we gotten ourselves into? And then we just started to walk, and it's just, everything looks so beautiful there. Maybe it's just because I'm biased, because I was so obsessed with Thebes for so long at that point. But I was like, oh, this is amazing. And that scholar I had talked to who was excavating in Thebes, she said, oh, you really have to go to the new archaeological museum. It's amazing. And that's partially built on part of the old Cadmea, so you can see part of it in underneath and outside. So I was just losing my mind. We stayed there for hours just looking at everything, and it was just so amazing to see all these, like, Theban artifacts in Thebes, and it was just the greatest.
Okay, I've got to go to Thebes next.
Yeah, you have to. It's amazing.
I'm gonna figure it out. I've got to. It's the problem is I travel all alone. And, like, I like traveling, but there's some parts of Greek travel that I don't love doing alone. Like, I did the bus to Nafplio. Like, the buses are fine. I'm probably going to figure out the bus, probably to Theba. Anyway, oh, I'm so jealous. That's so fun.
I wish I took a car, because the scholar.
This is my stupid issue.
I don't either. But
good,
thank you. This scholar, Stephanie Larson, she said, I really should go see the tombs of Oedipus. They're carved into the rock face itself, because the rock is very, like, malleable. And I was like, that's hardcore. I have to put that in the book. I didn't get to go to them, but just because she had talked about them, I had included it in the book.
Yeah.
But there's just so much to see there. So you have to go sometime.
I am having ideas that are going to result in me texting my lovely assistant producer, Michaela, after this. That's so fucking fun. I am so jealous. Okay, I love that too, because like the thing about basing your story in that part of the mainland is that there's so much close enough, you know, like it really, like, you can access all of these places and have people traveling in this way that is like realistic, but also you get to do, you know, Thebes and Delphi and kind of like whatever else in that sort of realm. Greece, now I'm just is there, you know, before we kind of like transition away from the plot itself, is there, you know, I don't know, anything like one favorite moment that you want to share, or just like, I don't even, just basically, do you want to share anything more about the plot or your characters, or just, I don't know, anything? So
I will share something very quickly. It's unexpected fan favorite. So I had more than one person talk to me about a certain character, and I thought, what? Because they were kind of just there for a reason. it's so hard to explain it. But so Ismene and Antigone are kept in the women's quarters. They're told that they're kept there for their own good because the plague is ravaging the city and this is the safest place for them. And they're kind of kept under lock and key by their nurse, Pyrrha. And Pyrrha had a long history in my head where she was not very good character in the first round of the book, but in the second round she became a much more motherly character. And I had beta readers and my sisters were saying, what's her story? She needs to do more. So she kind of became more of a central character through that second version of the story, just because so many people wanted to learn more about her. And even I was thinking about it, and it gave me an idea for a short story sometime, where a lot of, you know, Greek slaves were taken in war, and they were like, they weren't necessarily slaves before. Like, Pyrrha could have been a noblewoman or a princess herself. So the relationship she has with the two girls is not so much as a jailer as like a mother with her children. And it's just interesting to like try to revisit her relationship with Pyrrha, who was her only mother figure. So I have my beta readers to thank for that. So if we have readers out there who want to be writers and you don't always want to take your beta readers' feedback into account, you should, because there's a reason they're telling it to you. So try to make it work.
Well, I also think too, it's a great, like, I think the great kind of detail you added there is how is multiple people telling you that, you know, like, I think, I mean, if multiple people have told you a thing, like, probably it's a good idea to revisit for sure. I have just had two people who read my book be like, I think you should change this bit. And I'm like, fine, I guess I will. Like, you know, because, yeah, I think, you know, and within reason too, like, you know, and I think probably it was the same for you based on what you've just said. But like, for me, it was very like, well, I can see where you're coming from.
You don't want to admit it, but they're right.
exactly. Right. Like, whereas if you had felt particularly strongly about a thing, you could be like, no, like, that just doesn't work. You know, it's an interesting thing. And doesn't that just lead perfectly into what I think is so cool about what you've done? And what a lot of people do, is that, like, you just publish it yourself because it's working the traditional way. And I think that's great. And I think we're in this world where that is so much more possible than it used to be. So like, I would love to hear kind of like your, a little bit about your process and like what, you know, when you kind of were like, I'm just going to fucking do it.
That happened this year. I had, so I originally wrote the first draft 2017, and by 2019, I made that decision to rewrite it completely, and I was finished the rewrites by 2021. So I had been querying it to agents from 2021 to early 2023. So when we last talked last March, I was still in the depths of querying. I had good responses, but people just didn't know how to sell it, and I thought, how can you not sell it when Greek myth retellings are so popular right now? And I don't want to sound big-headed, but I know it's a good book. So I thought, Should I? There's a lot of stigma with self-publishing, but it is really valid and there's a lot of work that goes into it. And I was really fortunate that one of my coworkers self-publishes romance books. And she said, oh, just go for it. This is the name of my editor. Why don't you reach out to her? And if she's interested, she'll work with you. And the editor was interested. She actually told me, okay, so the editor used to be obsessed with Percy Jackson and Greek mythology in high school. And she said it made her want to revisit all of her high school phase. I was like, this is great. This is what I want. I want that high school audience and people to be excited about Greek myth. So I worked with them. And just at the point when we finished the edits and I needed to find a cover artist, I entered this contest, so I was very lucky. There's this wonderful illustrator online named Holly Dunn, and she does illustrations for a lot of like the book subscription boxes, like Owl Crate and Illumicrate. And she was running this contest where she would design a book cover for self-published artists. So I was like, what the heck? I'll enter it in. And then I won. So I was working with
that.
So it was just a lot of luck and support from other women that got me to self-publish this. So it was a nice little journey.
I love that so much. I've gotten really into watching book talks over the past year.
Oh, yeah.
Last year I was like in a real depressive hole about this time, and I started reading a romanticy novel and then got into book talk. Has really introduced me to so many self-published authors. And I think a lot of people talk some shit and I think they're wrong. Like,
yeah,
some of them actually could use an editor, but clearly you paid for one, so I'm sure yours is great. Sometimes I read things and I'm like, guys, you need to cut this in half. I would love to help you but not actually do it. But I do think that, like, by and large, indie publishing is fucking cool. And like, yeah, it's just so different. Like, because I went to publishing school, like grad school for publishing, but it was like, you know, 10 years ago. And self-publishing was even more stigmatized, and I think it's gotten a lot better. And now it's like this idea of indie publishing more. You know, it's like,
yeah,
you're just doing it for yourself. And I just think that's great. And I think BookTok has made that really, really possible. And so, like, I just love that you did it. Like, I think also you came to me at the right time when I was deep in my, like, BookTok romanticy times and reading all of the crazy nonsense I read on there. And I was like, you should do it for yourself. Look at all these people who are doing it. Like, it's so cool.
Yeah, and it is so great that there's so many people that have so many success stories, and it gives you a lot more freedom because a lot of the traditional publishers are looking for certain things, so you can break out of the box. You can make, like, I read a book about a Minotaur milking farm, and that's exactly what it sounds like, Liv. And it was a good book. I enjoyed it. So these things, like, you have freedom to write what you want. So even though a lot of agents were a bit hesitant to handle a story about a man who marries his mother, I got it out here.
Yeah. Oh my God. I love that. I love the idea of being able to do it yourself. I love that you won a contest for it. Like, how incredibly perfect too. That must have felt like such a good sign.
Like, yeah, it felt like destiny. Destiny plays a big part in the book. So I was like, okay, just go with it. Just go with it.
I just feel like that would feel like I'm doing the right thing. Like, I made the right call, especially because, like, getting rejected by publishers and authors and agents fucking sucks. That's a horrible feeling. And it can make you feel like the book isn't worth it. And I think, like you said, they are looking for a specific thing. And it doesn't mean that the thing that you've written is not going to be popular. It's just that traditional publishing is, like, very specific. And I think that it's absolutely valuable. And, like, I think that there's a place for both. But yeah, it's like, it doesn't always fit. And maybe it's when your dad is also your brother. Like, who's to say? I love that you did it yourself. And I think that's really cool. And I know my listeners like to hear a lot about, like, the process behind writing. But also, I think a lot of people try to write books and a lot of people feel discouraged. And the great thing about the world we live in now is you can do it yourself if you're so inclined.
Yeah, it's a lot of hard work, but, like, you can do it. Yeah. And the internet is a great place to learn things, and you can find people online that will help you. Like, I met so many people through another podcast called 88 Cups of Tea, which was big in the writing community back in the day, and that's how I met so many of my beta readers. So like, just reach out to your online friends. You can find people that'll write with you, and you can create your own writing circles, so you can make it happen even if an agent's not listening.
I think that's really great. And like, especially as somebody who used to work in publishing and did the whole thing, like, it's so different now in such a great way. Like, the world is so much more open to everybody. And especially when traditional publishing is like working to catch up with a lot of things, but they're so far behind on a lot of things, you know? And so like, sometimes you just have to go around them, and that's cool too.
Yeah. And even though you self-publish, a lot of self-published books are being picked up by traditional publishers now. So it doesn't mean that you're just going to be a self-published author forever, even though that's not a bad thing. Like,
no,
there's a lot more freedom through self-publishing, but there's a lot more, like you said, like some self-published authors can't afford to get an editor, but like, if you're with the publishing house, you get that treatment. So that's one of the advantages to traditional publishing. But like, they both have their own merits, and it's just really great that so many more people are able to self-publish things now.
It is. Yeah. So, well, I think that's a perfect way to say too, like, where can people find your book? Like, how is that working in that respect? And yeah, when is it available? This episode will come out, I think, after it's already been available, but you can tell me anyway, and where they can buy it.
Right. So it will be coming out January 30th, 2024. It's currently up for pre-order on Amazon for Kindle and paperback. And I am trying to work out Ingram Spark to get it in bookstores. So hopefully you'll be able to get it through your bookstores as well, but it's also there on Amazon.
Amazing. Now, from a completely personal standpoint, have you considered Kobo? And also, why not?
I don't know.
Great. Can I recommend that you consider Kobo? Not least because I know the woman who runs the entire Canadian store, and she's fucking lovely. Yeah, like, I just, yeah, it's so great that you're doing this. I was checking the date, so this will come out. Just looked at it and then I lost it. What do I have you? February 2nd. So when this episode comes out, it'll be fresh and new and available, and hopefully in stores, and hopefully on Kobo, as people will have lost a huge part of that conversation where I just talked about another option. But yeah, like, that's great. I hope that it does super well. I hope some of my listeners pick it up. More Thebes the better, but also like, yeah, more people doing it for themselves when the industry might let them down. So cool.
Yeah, I hope people like it.
I mean, that part's really scary.
Yeah,
but like, you don't, can't overthink it, so you just gotta hope for the best.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. This has been so much fun. What my listeners don't know is the number of times we stopped to talk about other random things that will get cut out, because I divulged a lot of information that is not yet public. But yeah, clearly this has been a true joy. Thank you so much for coming back on, Megan.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. This has just been such a great experience, and I'm so happy to be on the podcast again.
Well, I'm thrilled to have you, and thrilled to have your book in the world, especially like, after having dragged your poor episode out for so long before I released it, hoping that I would do the Thebian, and then realizing it's like 30 books long, and I was like, I am not prepared to do the Thebian yet. I'm glad to have you back. Wonderful nerds, thank you so much for listening to this episode. Thank you to Megan for coming on the show and for sharing everything about her novel and the writing process, because I love that part so much. But for me, it's really interesting to hear it from another classicist too, or just somebody who has studied classics, because when you have this level of absurd knowledge of the ancient world, I think it can be almost a hindrance sometimes, as you might have heard in some of those points, an obsession kind of with quote-unquote accuracy in a thing that has no need for accuracy, because mythology is mythology. So it's just like a unique experience chatting about that. And it was so much fun talking to Megan, and also Thebes, you know, Thebes. So huge thank you. And check out Riddles of the Sphinx, available at Kindle and now Kobo. And follow Megan. I've linked to some places in the episode's description. Enjoy. Thank you all so much for listening. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Michaela Smith is the Hermes to my Olympians, my assistant producer. Laura Smith is the wonderful audio engineer and production assistant. The podcast is part of the iHeart Podcasts Network. Listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Visit patreon.com/mythsbaby to help support the show. Can you tell I'm not reading my script this time? That was all from memory. I'm pretty good. Thank you all so much for listening. I am Liv, and I love this shit, particularly Thebes, because Thebes.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Need an easy button to feed your baby? Baby Brezza's Formula Pro Advanced makes a perfectly mixed warm formula bottle automatically at the push of a button. No air bubbles, no fuss. Literally, choose your temp, select your ounces, push start, and you're done. Works with virtually all formulas and bottles. Say goodbye to the 3 a.m. feeding chaos and hello to this revolutionary stress-free solution. Raising a baby is hard enough. Let Baby Brezza make feeding a breeze. Get your Formula Pro Advanced at babybrezza.com.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RiteRug.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.